Hello and welcome to Headnote, Pinson Mason's regular podcast from the Corporate Litigation Group, bringing updates, practical tips and thoughts, and reflections on what's new and going on in the courts at the moment. My name's John Fortnum, and I'm joined today by colleagues Chris Dryland and Andrew Herring. And we're going to spend some time in this first podcast from Headnote, looking at some recent cases to do with disclosure and a couple of developments to do with how the courts are responding to theft of confidential information. Really important, I know, to lots of our listeners. And also for those of you who are thinking about litigation, then some observations about a case around disclosure. One of the big challenges, I think, in modern litigation. Okay, but before we get into the law, here's some news.
From my perspective, it's Andrew Herring here. You might be interested to know that the civil courts are currently doing a review into their structure. They're going to get the first report back in July. Master Rolls is going to then be having a look at that, and we should have a publication later on in the year. So watch out for that, as it could have a real impact on how the high courts are operating.
Chris?
Yeah, interesting as well. The SRA, the Solicitors Regulatory Authority, they've issued a consultation paper considering changes to the SRA handbook of 2011, because we know that when that handbook came out, it was really looking at outcomes and kind of how people should behave rather than actual prescriptive rules. So they've issued a consultation now. The SRA handbook will be reviewed in two phases. This consultation comprises the first phase of that. I think the main proposals divide the code of conduct into two, one for individuals and one for law firms. So it'll be interesting to see what the outcome of that is. The consultation closed on the 21st of September 2016, but of course it will affect everyone, all practicing solicitors, both those who work for law firms and those who operate in-house.
So if that's of interest to any listeners, then why not drop us a line? We're at headnote@pinsonmasons.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And generally, we'd be delighted to hear from you on feedback or, you know, kind of future topics that would be interesting to you. But it's time now to get into our cases. And Andrew, you're going to share some thoughts on Gallagher.
Yes, John. One of the statistics which I've always been really shocked by as a litigator is that apparently about 50% of employees take their confidential information to their new employer. And it represents a huge risk for people in terms of protecting their IP and their commercially sensitive information. But the good news is we've had a recent case come out of the High Court where the courts are going to be backing up those people who are complaining about misuse of their confidential information. In short, the recent case involving some insurance brokers, the claimant was Arthur Gallagher. They complained about misuse of confidential information by an employee joining a competitor and then contacting a whole range, over 300 of their clients. The court has gone further than it ever has gone before in terms of delivery up of confidential information, and it gave an additional order that they would that the defendants had to destroy the confidential information as well. So great news for people who have suffered at the hands of employees who've taken confidential information to competitors.
And that's really interesting, isn't it? Because often we advise on these situations that you can never be sure that information hasn't going to find its way back into the use of the former employee or their new employer. And so really, as you say, interesting that the courts are intervening in a practical way to give some real value for money, I suppose, in terms of that application.
And I think, in actual fact, what this case represents is the courts catching up with commercial practice. Yeah. Because quite often the solution to one of these situations is to request that the wrongdoer and potentially even the new employer as well provide some undertakings to deliver up and destroy that confidential information which has gone to them. So really this decision represents the courts catching up with that sort of commercial way of resolving these disputes.
And removes any doubt about whether the undertakings be complied with.
Absolutely, yeah. So in this situation the court also ordered independent forensic investigators would come in and supervise the destruction. And not only that, there were fail-safes built into the court order so that an image was retained by those independent forensic investigators, preserved, so that if something had been destroyed inadvertently, it could still be recovered. So there was some fail-safes built in to protect the defendants in this case.
I think what's particularly interesting as well is genuinely new law, isn't it? Because in this case, the courts actually looked whether there's any previous authority on this point, and there wasn't. So this is really an extension and a new development in the law.
And I think as someone who practices in this area, I was quite surprised, because we do see these undertakings with the destruction of material on a regular basis, but it's fantastic news that it's been clarified, and it puts claimants in a much stronger position when dealing with wrongdoers who've taken confidential information.
Now, this case, of course, is in the context of the employer-employee relationship, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think what will be interesting to see what the direction of travel is and see if it's then extended further and dealing with all sorts of confidential information, even those outside the employer-employee relationship.
And I think I've seen that in terms of joint venture partners. You know, they share information for a project and then they don't win, they go their separate ways. And so, again, I suppose it encourages disclosure in order to get the project. But if they're unsuccessful, then there's a kind of regime, isn't there, in which that they can agree to destroy what they had and move on. So you're listening to Headnote, the corporate litigation podcast from Pinson Masons. So we're today looking at a couple of cases and their implications, which we think are relevant to our in-house counsel teams that we work with. And our next case, Chris, you're going to share some recent developments around disclosure.
That's right, yeah, it's also on the issue of disclosure, and this is the case of Hunter Worldwide Premium Sourcing Limited and Lawless. Well, I think what it demonstrates that courts will really take a proactive approach to managing disclosure in terms of case management and won't just basically sit back and let the parties get on with it themselves. We've all been in the situation of disclosure. It's a long-winded task. It's obviously document-heavy. It's laborious. It's not the most interesting task. It can be extremely time-consuming, but it is really important that it's done. Basically, what happened in Hunter Worldwide was that the claimant had alleged that the first defendant had misappropriated some £2.3 million from both itself and from another company. But what was really key to the first defendant's defence was it argued that proper disclosure was necessary in order to show that these payments had been made and how they were authorised. And the first defendant claimed that the claimant hadn't actually made proper disclosure. Now, the defendant, the first defendant, threatened to make an application for disclosure, but so in the light of that, the client agreed to undertake a further search and disclose a further 1,600 pages of spreadsheets, and basically said to the first defendant they had to get on with it and search through them themselves, which wasn't perhaps the most helpful approach. Now, what the judge held was that the judge ordered that an independent expert should actually go in and search the claimant's computer systems and records and then report back to the court. It also ordered that this should be done completely independently with no intervention at all from either of the parties to make sure it could be really truly independent. It's an interesting case because what it demonstrates, firstly, is the importance to get disclosure right first, because otherwise costs can really rack up when we then make an application to the court. But I think, secondly, it also demonstrates the courts will really intervene and effectively get the parties by the scruff of the neck and get stuck in if it needs to.
And that was always the intention, wasn't it, behind the Wolf reforms back in 97, that there'd be some judicial banging of heads together. I remember Lord Wolf saying that in his report, but it's maybe taking, 20 years to get to that place where the courts are prepared to kind of get stuck in.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's taken, you know, a few years since the subsequent Jackson reforms for the courts to really get their head around how they can be muscular about case managing cases and bringing them to trial in a proportionate way. Mm. And this just seems to me like another example where the courts are going to be taking parties to task if they're not prepared to cooperate on the areas of the case where cooperation is absolutely essential to managing the costs of the exercise.
I think you're absolutely right. I think kind of a more muscular approach is absolutely right, is the way to describe it. Because you look at the way in which, for example, the courts are now striking out cases or statements of case for failure to comply with orders of the court. They really are taking a much more robust sort of approach to failure to comply with the rules, and also some of the unnecessary tactical stances that parties are taking.
Absolutely. And disclosure is one of those areas where they have built in express requirements into the civil procedure rules to make parties cooperate with each other in advance of the case management conference, and it's stated very clearly in the practice direction to Part 31 that parties need to have talked to each other, they need to have agreed the scope of disclosure before getting into the CMC, and I think the consequence of that is if parties don't do that and there are subsequent disputes, the courts are going to come down hard on the parties, and I'd be really interested to know what the cost consequences of this particular skirmish will be if this case goes to trial and someone's having to do a summary assessment.
Okay, so we want these discussions to be as practical as they can be. You know, I'm going to ask the question, I think, on a regular basis, guys. So what? You know, what can our in-house team be thinking about in terms of before they get into a dispute, and if they do happen to get into a dispute?
I think the importance really is thinking about disclosure at an early stage. If you just start thinking about disclosure the month before your list of documents are due to be exchanged, it's far too late. I think right at the beginning of a dispute, you really need to look at disclosure, what documents you've got, and also communicate with the party so you can agree and hopefully agree what the scope of disclosure will be.
Litigation is won or lost on the evidence, and I completely agree with Chris. Thinking about disclosure right from the outset, making sure you've preserved evidence, and then you can access it in a way which means that you can have sensible discussions with your opponent to get things agreed, is the way to go.
And I just wonder whether actually, you know, the business colleagues need to know a bit more about where their email could end up. You know, I wonder how people would communicate if they knew that an independent might come and, you know, rake through their emails in the context of a dispute a couple of years down the line.
I'm often asked by my clients, what is the extent of disclosure? So we're talking about the courts and them being more muscular about what documents need to be provided to the court in order to resolve a dispute. It's not just emails. The rules, again, make it very clear that if, for example, the business is using an instant messenger system, it's going to encompass that. Potentially, if it includes communications between salespeople who are out on the road all the time, mobile phone records and text messages may be really important. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the CPR rules actually include deleted material. So in circumstances where there's been some wrongdoing, where the authenticity of documentation and what happened is in dispute, the courts may be ordering parties to go and look into even more detail on their electronically stored information.
Okay, so that's about all for this, our first episode of Headnote. There's, as I say, we'd be keen to receive your feedback at headnote@pinsonmasons.com. And we'll be back again shortly with perhaps a more detailed look at some of these prevention tips around disclosure and steps that the court are taking to trim down the resolution of disputes in a particular field that could be of more wider application. So thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading Headnote. We'll look forward to joining you again shortly.